Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. Thanks again for joining us for another edition of Midrats. We appreciate you taking time of your day to join us and our guests as we talk about the things we like to talk about. And if you're with that esteemed group of folks that are actually with us live, as opposed to getting it via the podcast, if you'd like to contribute, if you scroll to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show. And if you have some observations you would like to share, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guest during the course of the show, that's the perfect place to put it. Also, if you got to run off and take care of some errands and you want to catch up on what you missed, or if you want to check out some previous episodes, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Or if you are so inclined, you can take a shortcut and just subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or some of the other podcast aggregators about. But let's go ahead and get on with the show. For those that have been paying attention, during the course of the year, it's been interesting to watch over on the ground side of the house, where there's a lot of discussion, a lot of writing about how we, the Imperial we, need to learn how to fight a conventional battle again after years of focusing on counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency, of course, has not gone anywhere. But what we haven't been focused on is fighting against an enemy that's holding territory, has a capital, armor, artillery, and a proven record on the battlefield and standing and taking ground. While some have been writing about it, others have actually been living it while keeping counterinsurgency in one hand in the other, has been fighting side by side with traditional allies and a few new ones in a complicated joint and combined environment that really is hallmarked the latest chapter in the long war, and that was the war against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. We've brought a great guest for you today to discuss this and more, a returning guest. He's just gotten back a couple of months ago from leading his Marines of Task Force Lion. And the fight is Colonel Seth Folsom, U.S. Marine Corps. Colonel Folsom is a Marine Corps infantry officer with 24 years of commissioned service. He currently works over in the staff of 1st Marine Expeditionary Force. He's commanded Marines in Iraq and Afghanistan at the company, battalion, and task force level. He's a graduate of the University of Virginia Navy Postgraduate School and the Marine Corps War College. He's the author of three books about Marines in the Long War, and he's currently living along with his family in lovely Oceanside, California. Seth, welcome back to Midrats.
Hey, thanks, gents. It's great to be back here.
And we figured we'd give you a couple of months off before we brought on and started throwing quizzes at you, but I know you've been busy, and we really do appreciate you taking time today to share your story.
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's definitely good to be back on the show and good to be back in the States as well.
As a scene setter, is when you took command of Task Force Lion, that was the fifth rotation, and a lot of the listeners here, especially those that have previously served or have family members that have, they're familiar with rotational deployments where you know where you're going. You've been watching your predecessors who are there. You've probably talked to a couple of them, get a feel for it. You have an idea what your mission set's going to be. You set about training your Marines and expect the future may or may not be what the past has been. And lo and behold, you show up. And you and the people you're leading have a little bit different challenge you may have had. If you could take for a moment and describe to the listener the history of Task Force Lion, what you and your Marines were training for leading up to it, and what y'all actually found yourself executing once in theater.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. See, Task Force Lion, you know, it actually began, its original name was Task Force Al-Assad. and it's original form, it was simply an advise and assist team. You know, a classic advisor team that was about 26 Marines and sailors that went to Iraq in late 2014 to help the Iraqi army, you know, as it was trying to fight back ISIS. So there were two teams that the Marine Corps was manning. One was Task Force Al-Asad that was at Al-Asad Air Base, and the second was called Task Force Takadum, which was at Al-Takadum Air Base near Ramadi. So both advisor teams, they were responsible for advising and assisting the Iraqi security forces in Al-Anbar province. And what both teams realized really quickly was that, you know, the Iraqi security forces that were left, and in Task Force Al-Assad's case, it was the 7th Iraqi Army Division, those Iraqi soldiers and officers and the staffs, they didn't need as much advising as they did enabling. And so those original small advisor teams didn't have the enabling capabilities that they needed to really help the Iraqis get after ISIS and to begin shaping the battlefield for ultimately what would be the clearance and the liberation of Al-Anbar. So both of those teams, Task Force Takadum and Task Force Al-Assad, they started getting plussed up with Marines and sailors and members of the joint force and our coalition and partnered force as well, and different capabilities that they needed to make the Iraqis successful. And what those capabilities looked like was increased ISR, increased intelligence collection and processing and analysis. There was an increase in fire support, both surface delivered and aviation delivered. There was also an increase in logistics support, logistics enabling functions, helping them figure out their own ammunition system, their own maintenance system, and things like that. So over time, Task Force Al-Assad grew from 26 Marines and sailors to about 80 to 85, almost 90 people at the core of the task force's headquarters. So by the time I was selected to take rotation 5 over to Iraq, the Marine Corps had realized that it had not really been sourcing these teams the best way, because the sourcing for each team had been a one-off. They were pulled from many different elements in country. The teams were not getting the chance to train together back in the States before they deployed. And so for continuity's sake and unity of command and to increase the effects that the team was providing for the Iraqis, we began building what we were calling purpose-built task forces, where we would take that core of 26 Marines and sailors from the get-go and add on all of the personnel needed to build the actual team in the States, task organized like a battle staff, do the training, send them forward as a complete team so that they could support the Iraqis and participate in the campaign. So my team, Roto 5, was the first rotation for Task Force Al-Assad that was the purpose-built task force. As it turned out, it was a great concept. It worked. It didn't just work in theory. It worked in action. And we were fortunate enough to arrive, right as the tide had turned against ISIS, and the emphasis and the attention was directed from the operations that were going on in Mosul in the north to Western Al-Anbar, which was still completely held by ISIS. So that was the situation that we walked into in August of last year, of 2017. The teams that had formed Task Force Al-Assad before we got there, they had largely, for the most part, they'd been static at Al-Assad. They had been doing all of their advising and assisting and enabling for the Iraqi security forces. They'd been doing it all from their COC at Al-Assad Air Base. What we were, timing is everything, and what we were fortunate enough to walk into was when the campaign made its shift to Western Al Anbar, some of the first direction that I got from the general who was commanding the coalition's ground component command, some of the first direction that he gave me was, to support the Iraqis, you're going to need to move outside the base. I don't think that you can properly support them from inside the wire here. And so that was a paradigm shift for me and for everybody on my team, because what we had essentially trained up to prior to our deployment was we thought we were going to be working in the COC inside the wire the entire time. And really what one of the things that made us able to take that leap and move outside the wire was a lot of the emphasis that we placed during our training on just basic Marine things like convoy operations, tactical vehicle operations, security operations, basic weapons handling and weapons employment, all the things that Marines are good at that usually have to be used in just about every mission that you execute. So when we had to make that shift to go from being a static advise, assist, and enable force to a mobile force that was moving outside the wire with the Iraqis as they were moving through Al Anbar, we were ready. And like I said, timing is everything. And at the same time, I was blessed to have a team of, you know, a bunch of Marines and sailors, officers, staff NCOs, young NCOs, and young enlisted Marines who were incredibly talented and incredibly flexible and agile. And the combination of those three traits, the talent, the flexibility, the agility, and really a fourth one, and that was just being generally hungry to do something, that was what enabled our success in supporting the Iraqis.
Well, I know you were in Iraq previously. Let's talk a little bit about the changes that you observed between in your book, The Highway War, what you were doing and how the Iraqis now react to the U.S. Presence as a helper for them.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, I'm not a really original guy, and I tend to pull a lot of my quotes from books and movies and other things that have shaped my life and my perspective. And I've heard it said before, but I will say this, that going back to Iraq this time, with my two previous experiences there in 2003 and again in 2008, going back this time was kind of like returning to the scene of a crime. And the reason I say that is, you know, in 2003, we were doing conventional operations during the invasion. As a company commander, I was the things that I was focused on were things like employment of combined arms and the logistics that were required to get my company from Kuwait to Baghdad and to Crete, and all of the basic individual Marine actions that make Marines successful in combat. So, and then, you know, when I went in. When I went back in 2008 as an advisor, I was focused on very different things. I was focused on, you know, the relationship building that's required when you're an advisor to a foreign force. I was focused on things like force protection and how to secure my force when we were completely partnered with and living with our Iraqi counterparts. And I was focused on things like, you know, trying to convey a message or carry a message to my Iraqi partner without losing him along the way, whether it's because of a translation issue or because of cultural differences. So having those two sets of experiences under my belt when I returned last year, again, it was there were a lot of flashbacks, a lot of, you know, this is how we did it before versus this is how it's going now. And the problem set that faced us when we began planning for the clearance of Al Anbar, which ended up being Op Desert Lion, the problems that faced us were the same problems that faced me both in 2003 and in 2008. It was the Iraqi scheme of maneuver to get from the area just west of Haditha all the way out to the border, it was a logistics nightmare. It was also a fire support, from a surface perspective, it was a surface fire support nightmare too, because of the speed that they could move, and we had to ensure that we had fire bases set up to support the Iraqi security forces with the surface delivered fire support that they needed. Throughout all of this, it was an advising challenge. It was the relationship that I had to build with my partner, who was a two-star Iraqi general. I had to build that relationship very quickly and give him what he needed, not necessarily what he wanted. And we had to do all of this in an extremely resource-constrained environment. Because of where that operation fell in the overall campaign and some of the overall constraints that we had in theater as far as personnel limitations and capability limitations.
I'd like to flesh that out a bit for the listener, just to put some context in it. As you described earlier, you went from "we're not leaving to wire" to "that we're going to leave the wire and supporting the Iraqis." But the numbers for Task Force Lion while you're in command are pretty incredible. You didn't just leave the wire and move forward. The figure that I read in one of the presentations that you gave is you partnered with the Iraqi security forces as they advanced more than 3,700 square miles of battle space, 100 tactical ground movements, totaling a difference of over 11,000 miles. And that wasn't at all a U.S. show with U.S. logistics where we bring everything, including the video games, but that was on Iraqi terms and under Iraqi methods. Explain how y'all were able to put that logistics support. Describe a little bit how those accustomed to American logistics would see how the Iraqi operations, and how you and your Marines were able to prepare from inside the wire to outside the wire and covering 11,000 miles just for your own support.
Yeah, thanks for that. See, so that's the, when I look back on what my team did, I think that was really the genius behind the idea of a purpose-built task force, because for all intents and purposes, the task force was considered to be a brigade-level team. And what I mean by that is in Iraq at the time, there were several different ground units, and one of those ground units was a complete Army brigade combat team, led by a colonel. And again, the general who commanded the ground component command in Iraq, he considered both Task Force Lion and Task Force Spartan, which is what that was the new name for Task Force Dukatum. He considered those two task forces in Anbar province as equivalent to brigade combat team headquarters. And so what we were able to do with my relatively small but again flexible and agile staff was we were able to accept other units and to be appropriately task organized by our higher headquarters. So when the commanding general made the decision that Task Force Lion is going to be the unit that goes forward with the Iraqis, he then said, okay, they will receive this degree of support. So we began bolting on a series of U.S. and coalition enablers to help us help the Iraqis. And what that looked like was, our small 85-man headquarters continue to be the headquarters nucleus. We got a few people that were added to that to help us, to give us some staff depth. But what the task force became was we had, for example, a U.S. Army artillery battalion headquarters and a couple of its batteries attached to us. We had a French artillery battalion attached to us. We had a Marine Corps infantry battalion headquarters and a company attached to us. We had a series of these combat enablers all bolted on to the core of our task force, and that was how we swelled from this very small advise and assist team to this 2,300 member, you know, joint coalition organization that helped move the Iraqis across the desert. And, you know, what that looked like for the Iraqis was we would help them develop their plans, their tactical plans, to get them from point A to point B. And then we would have to build, in concert with that, we would have to build a supporting plan that would get our, you know, personnel, equipment, weapons, ammunition, supplies, et cetera, to get them to intermediate staging bases and fire bases where that were usually adjacent to the Iraqi positions as they were advancing forward. And we had to time the entire thing out to ensure that we were in the right place at the right time to support the ISF. Otherwise, they would either do it without us, which could be bad, or they wouldn't do it at all, which could be worse. So it was a delicate balancing act to ensure that, you know, we were all delivering the same message to the Iraqis, and that there were lines that we couldn't cross. There were things that they wanted us to do that we logistically couldn't do, or we were not resourced appropriately to do. So it was as much a logistical and a fire support and intelligence operation as it was a cultural balancing act with the Iraqis.
Let's talk a little bit about ISIS and the news we get here is never fully capable of describing them. Could you talk about the enemy that the Iraqis and your group was facing, and how sophisticated were they? How much of the reputation they have for viciousness was accurate?
Yeah, I'll tell you. ISIS and the people that follow ISIS, they are, you know, they were an enemy worth fighting. You know, they were an enemy worth hating too. There was not a lot of when we were over there. There was not a lot of sympathy for ISIS fighters. There was not a lot of why are we here. Because, you know, people like me knew what ISIS had been doing in Iraq and Syria for the past several years. You know, and what I've told people before is, you know, in the opening days of what has become Operation Inherent Resolve, I was on the ground floor of all of this in the Pentagon, and I remember the reports coming in from the U.S. Embassy saying that Baghdad is going to be overrun by ISIS and its advancing columns. I remember the videos in high def of American and foreign journalists getting their heads cut off. And I remember the Jordanian pilot being burned alive in a cage and then being crushed with rocks. I remember that stuff, and that's why I had no sympathy for what was about to happen to ISIS when the Americans and the coalition rolled in hard on them. What I'll tell you that is interesting about them, though, is, you know, you had mentioned earlier balancing conventional operations with counterinsurgency. What I had been used to during my 2008 tour in Iraq and my 2011 tour in Afghanistan was I was used to an enemy that didn't wear a uniform. You know, I was used to guys that blended into the population, and it made targeting them very challenging, and it made made us preventing civilian casualties a priority because of the difficulty of targeting people that are part of the population, and that's exactly what ISIS did as well. But it was interesting to watch because when we got there in August of 2017, you know, Mosul was still churning a little bit, but the battle in Mosul was pretty much over. And in the western half of Al-Anbar province, the ISIS fighters in cities like Ana and Rawa and Rayana and Ubaidi and Al-Qaim and all the population centers that approach the Syrian border, the ISIS fighters out there were still they were still emboldened, and what? In just a second here, they were still emboldened, and they had they weren't afraid of walking around in what we consider a traditional ISIS uniform, which was typically, you know, black fatigues, a tan tack vest, a really long beard, carrying an AK-47 or some other kind of prestige weapon, and they had no fear. But as the ISF and Anbar province began to gain ground in late 2016, early 2017, and into the summer, we started seeing these fighters. There weren't a whole lot of guys that were really faithful anymore. They stopped walking around wearing their tack vests. A lot of them started shaving their really long beards. They stopped carrying weapons in public like AK-47s because they knew, one, they knew that the ISF was coming, and they also knew that we were targeting them. So kind of what the point I'm getting to is, as we got closer to the border and closer to the Al-Qaim district, it became more challenging to target the fighters because they blended in with the population more. So you know, from the get-go, there was always a concern on my part and the part of my targeters that we absolutely, to the extent possible, prevent any civilian casualties. But that ramped up even more as we got closer to the border, especially when we knew that if the border and the Al-Qaim district was going to be really the final battle in Al-Anbar province, it was going to be ours to lose if we ended up targeting civilians.
I think in one of our previous emails, one thing that I kind of offhand mentioned is, one of the things I wanted to talk about was the return of the queen of the battlefield. Is there's a long and storied tradition and relationship between the U.S. military and her artillery branches. Like the old joke from, you know, the Germans in World War II, you know, how do you know whether you have fired on British or Americans? If you fired on the British, you'll receive a lot of aimed rifle fire. If you fire on Americans, then you will be killed under a barrage of artillery. But back when we were still kids, after 9/11, we kind of, for a variety of reasons, pushed artillery back into the background. In most cases, we bragged in the early part of the Afghan operation about leaving our artillery behind. There's Mattis's great quote. But you had an opportunity to not only bring the queen back, but to experience something that I kind of mentioned in the show prep. That's the joint, i.e. working closely with our sister services and also combined working with our allies. And you integrated into your operation U.S. Army artillery and French artillery. Talk a little bit about how all the training we've all done to be able to do that, how that actually works in practice, and from your previous deployments, having that capability to use against an enemy you rightfully said is worth fighting and worth hating, how that was as a professional.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, one of the things that I realized more so on this deployment than previous deployments is that I think in the modern age and in this kind of warfare, you know, having joint terminal attack controllers, well, you know, what everybody knows as JTACs, they are they're the pacing item, and in a campaign like this, and your number and quality of JTACs can directly impact how well you prosecute the campaign. In our particular case, you know, I was fortunate. I had three JTACs on my team. I also had an air officer who was JTAC qualified. And the reason that those individuals, the reason those Marines were so important was because, like you said, by the time Op Desert Lion kicked off, we had a U.S. Army artillery battalion with M777s. We had a detachment of U.S. Army HIMARS rocket launchers. And then we had a French artillery battalion that was called Task Force Wagram that was employing mobile 155-millimeter artillery called Caesars, which, by the way, is the loudest thing I've ever heard on the battlefield. Absolutely blows your mind when you're standing next to them. But we had these, so we had these enabling capabilities, these surface-delivered fire support assets that were attached to us as part of the task force, and we had to speak a common language, and the common language was through our targeters, our fire support Marines, and our JTACs, that they all understood the employment, the effects, and just as important, the planning to employ these assets in support of the Iraqis. It's interesting because, you know, like you said, you know, in 2003 during the invasion, I mean, I could not believe the amount of artillery that we fired, you know, in 21 days. And it's some of the craziest stuff I've ever seen and heard. In 2008, there was no artillery in Iraq, and we had artillery in Afghanistan, but the only artillery that we delivered against the Taliban was all precision-guided munitions. And it was the same thing with HIMARS. So then, flash forward to 2017 with Task Force Lion, and we were firing a lot of artillery to support the Iraqis. Some of it was precision-guided. Some of it was good old-fashioned iron in the dirt. And the reason that we could fire, you know, unguided munitions was because of the skill that our forward observers and our targeters and our planners had in putting the rounds downrange to hit what they needed to. And in particular, you know, the unit that fired the most unguided ammunition was the French. With their Caesar systems, they could just cook off round after round that was extremely accurate without being a very expensive piece of precision-guided munitions. And then what was also gratifying to see is the competition that goes on between among the American teams in who's more accurate and who can get more rounds downrange, but the competition between the Americans and the French. And I'll tell you, I'll be completely honest with you. People downplay a lot of times or denigrate the actions of the French. Task Force Wagram and the support that they provided us was absolutely unbelievable. All they wanted to do the entire time was shoot. They said they were constantly coming to me saying, asking, how can we shoot more? How can we shoot more? We're ready to shoot more. And so anytime we needed them, they were ready and they were firing a hell of a lot of brass.
When you had air support, where were you getting the air support? Was it also coalition or U.S. military or Iraqis or all three?
Yeah, it was all the air support we got was coalition. It was it was a combination of you know, U.S. Marines, Navy, Air Force. It was also that we had Belgian, U.K., French, Danish. The air campaign that was in support of the Iraqis was 100% a combined and coalition effort. The one caveat that we had was we would not control Iraqi aviation, nor would we call them in for support, because from our perspective, they just weren't there yet. And We had a couple of close calls with some of their aviation, especially in the beginning when one of their jets dropped a couple of 500-pounders about 200 or 300 meters from my Norwegian team that was out with the Iraqis. So after that, any consideration that there might have been on employing the Iraqi Air Force was dead on arrival.
You know, it's interesting with the fact that y'all are operating out of Anbar. In a previous interview you did, you kind of described what many people are familiar with AMBAR is the fabric of Western AMBAR. This is a, I'm quoting you, by the way. Quote, the fabric of Western AMBAR is composed of many different tribes, and within those tribes, everybody knows everybody, unquote. The first thing that came to mind was Bing West's 2008 book about the Marines in AMBAR, the strongest tribe. The Marines have a history there, but we, the Imperial we, the U.S., we decamped out of Iraq in AMBAR, and we came back into AMBAR after AMBAR had been, for lack of a better phrase, at least from a distance, traumatized from the experience of the invasion of the Islamic State. With the Marines in AMBAR and with your team, I'm sure you had a mixture of people like yourself that had been to Iraq before, but also the nature of this business. It is a young man, a young woman's business, a lot of people on their first deployment. But what was new in AMBAR from our perspective after they had been on the receiving end of the Islamic State and we were working in support of the Iraqis' own forces to move north and west?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I'll tell you, I think the most important change in the Iraqis between 2008, when I was there before, and this past year was really their willingness to listen to the advice that we were giving and to the suggestions we were making for the support of their campaign. In 2008, one of the things that I've explained to a lot of people is in 2008, the advisor team that I was with, I really didn't have a whole lot to offer my Iraqi partner. You know, what we used to say was that the Iraqis didn't really want what was between our ears, that they wanted what was in our pockets. You know, they wanted, back in 2008, they wanted fuel, or they wanted ammunition or spare parts or, you know, generators or whatever. And I didn't have that stuff to give. And so a lot of times the relationship between me and my partner in 2008 was extremely strained, because what it came down to was just most nights, you know, the two of us smoking cigarettes and drinking hot tea and looking at each other, because he had no compelling reason to do anything for me because I couldn't do a whole lot for him. So all that changed with the campaign and inherent resolve and how we're working with the Iraqis now. And I think it changed for two reasons. One, because we did have something to offer them this time. And that was essentially, hey, look, I can give you this intelligence capability. I can give you this aviation and surface delivered fire support capability. I can help you with your logistics processes. So they had a more compelling reason to listen to us because we had things and capabilities to offer, and they had a more compelling reason to work with us because they had a legitimate enemy who had cut through their country. In 2008, you know, I frequently told people in 2008 I was in more danger of, you know, blowing out my back in the gym or having an Iraqi soldier accidentally shoot me on a training range than I was from the enemy in Western AMBAR. Completely different in 2017. In 2017, ISIS was still going strong. They were still killing a lot of Iraqi soldiers and civilians. And the Iraqi security forces that I was working with, they were more willing to listen to what I had to say because they knew that essentially I was the guy that said yes or no to the things that would help support them. So there was, like I said, there was that willingness on their part to listen and to work with us. But at the same time, I think part of that comes from the relationships that the Americans and the Marines had built with the ISF and AMBAR over the previous decade. You know, when I returned to Al Asad in 2017, I was supporting the 7th Iraqi Army Division, which is the same division that I supported in 2008 as an advisor and as a major. And so what I found out really quickly was there were a lot of Iraqi officers left in the division and in the Corps who knew who I was just because I'd been there before. And so I was able to actually have conversations with them saying, hey, do you know where so-and-so is now, or do you remember so-and-so? And the same thing happened with the officer who replaced me this past spring. He had worked directly with the current division, the current Iraqi division commander. So the two of them seeing each other after, you know, almost 10 years, it was like they were long lost brothers. So those relationships that we had built back in the 2006, 7, 8, 9 time frame, they paid dividends when it came to working with the Iraqis again in this campaign.
How complicated, I mean, given the serious situation, were you involved at all in the complications of the way that Syria has played out with all the competing parties there, and how did that play into what you were doing, if it played at all?
Yeah, I'll tell you, probably one of the most frustrating aspects of our time over there was the Syria situation. And what was most frustrating to me and my staff about it was that we essentially predicted that this was what was going to happen. As we were helping the Iraqi officers develop their plan to get to the Syrian border, with all the different actors that were on the battlefield, the direction we were steering them was, we were saying, you need to close the back door to Syria. You cannot just squeegee ISIS, going from east to west and push them all into Syria, because it's just going to prolong the problem. And you have to figure out a way to deal with the Popular Mobilization Front, the PMF units that become part of the Iraqi security force apparatus. So we highlighted and underscored all of these issues with our Iraqi partners beforehand, and they gave us the north-south and nodded their heads and said, "Yep, you're absolutely right. We've got to figure out how to deal with it." And they continued with their original plan, which was essentially a frontal assault on the Al-Qaim district, which is that's the border district that shares the border with Abu Kamal in Syria. Their operation amounted to a frontal assault on Al-Qaim with no way to secure the border until the city had already been cleared. So once they had the city cleared by the beginning of November, what our analysis led to was that all of the remaining ISIS fighters that were in the district had simply moved west across the border into Syria and Abu Kamal. So once the Iraqis had secured Al-Qaim and by extension had secured all of Western Anbar, there was still a significant problem across the border over in Syria, and in particular in our area of interest, which was Abu Kamal, right across the border. And so what that really led to was it led to Task Force Lion and the coalition leaving a sizable contingent in Al-Qaim at the old train station there to enable the Iraqi 8th Division, which had been left as the holding force in the Al-Qaim district, to assist and enable them out there, and really to provide a bulwark against the remaining ISIS components that were across the border in Syria. And so, you know, this entire time, we're watching this kind of, you know, it looks like a disaster. It looks like a slow-motion train wreck where we had this mixture on the battlefield of Iraqi army, Iraqi PMF, Syrian pro-regime forces, ISIS forces, Syrian democratic forces, and they were all converging in the same area. And so it made the campaign, and it made our targeting process and our support to the Iraqis much more challenging than it would have been otherwise. The comparison that we began making on the team as we were planning, helping the Iraqis plan this campaign to get to the border and Al-Qaim, we began comparing that to Berlin and the race to get to Berlin in World War II. Who was going to get there first? Was it going to be the Iraqi security forces supported by the Americans? Or was it going to be, you know, the Syrian pro-regime forces supported by the Russians? Or was it going to be the SDF? It was pretty pretty eye opening. And I think that we were just fortunate that we were able to compel the Iraqis, and they had the support of their government, and they had the support of the U.S. and the coalition governments to get after it and get to the border in the time that they did. Because my sense is, if they hadn't, then there would probably be a lot of bleed over from the Syrian side at this point.
There's some combination of the fall of Berlin and Game of Thrones, the complicated interplay of all the different players there is just.
But it's funny you say that, because I had several Marines on my team who always referred to the Game of Thrones comparison. And after a while, I had to turn to them and say, "Hey, look, guys, I've never seen one episode of Game of Thrones." So the way I looked at it was, I called it the Sons of Anarchy model, because that's what we used, and that's how we referenced things in Afghanistan, and it fit a lot in Anbar province as well, where you had these different disparate teams of, you know, these different groups of actors who all had their own agendas, had their own incentives, would cut deals to work with each other, maybe not permanently, but temporarily. They in a lot of ways had their own fiefdoms and their own programs. We had to figure out, you know, how to work with them, understanding that none of them, and the way that they acted and the systems that they would impose if they had the opportunity, none of it was what we would like it to look like. You know, we would like it to look like the idyllic American, you know, scenario of law, peace and law enforcement and all of that and due process, and none of it's going to look like what we'd want it to look like.
Now, from a distance, I've tried mapping some of that stuff out, and, you know, people make jokes about three-dimensional chess, trying to understand who's who in the zoo and why. It's, you know, three-dimensional Venn diagrams. On Thursday, these three people will be able to work together, but on Tuesday, only two of them will. It's ridiculous. And it kind of ties into a question. I mean, to say beyond our almost 17-year history there, I mean, to say Iraq has a troubled history is an understatement and a half. But in the last decade and a half, that country and all their different groups, whether the Shia, the Sunni, the Kurds, the, you know, real minorities, the Christian, the Yazidis, they've been seared by layer after layer of violence and a variety of terrorist organized violence and insurgencies. And when we look at, you touched on a little bit there, I think it's safe to say that we're somewhere close to an end game against the Islamic State held land in Syria and their forces. That's working itself out in Syria. And as that end game comes out to play, where do you see the Iraq opportunity after this latest Syrian experience? Do they have an opportunity for at least a few years of stability, or are there other things in the wings that could just lay out another chapter and another front in another wave of violence that they should expect?
Yeah, and I tell you what, if I could answer that, I'd get the Nobel Prize. But
I'll give you a PhD for.
I'll tell you this, because, you know, I said it before, and I'll say it again. I had a phenomenal staff on my team, a bunch of highly educated officers and staff NCOs, and we talked about this stuff all the time. You know, we would sit around late at night sometimes trying to figure out a way and the way to make things work, or how, you know, what does the future of Iraq look like? And I've said it before, I've said it on the record, and I'll continue to say it, that, you know, I do think that the United States has an obligation to Iraq. I mean, you know, let's be frank. We broke that place in 2003. There's no doubt about it. And we have an obligation to help them find a way ahead. But they also have an obligation. They can't use, you know, back in 2008, I had these conversations with my partner, And he wasn't too blunt about it, but he would periodically imply that, well, you guys screwed us up, so you need to fix us. And back in 2008, I could buy that argument. This time around, I don't buy it as much. What I do think is that we have an obligation to help them move forward, give them support, give them advice, help them find solutions to the wicked problems that they face. But it has to be a transactional relationship. It's the same kind of relationship that I had to build with my Iraqi partner this last time with Task Force Lion. And I know that a lot of people don't like to use the term transactional relationship because, you know, you have a transactional relationship with a hooker, right? But it has to be give and take. If they want us to help them, they have got to be willing to help themselves. And what I mean by helping themselves is they've got to be willing to make some hard calls, and they've got to there have to be caveats in the relationship. There have to be conditions. It cannot be, you know, the U.S. and the coalition just providing money and kinetic capabilities and intelligence collection and things like that. Because as far as I'm concerned, Iraq will never be back to normal as long as there are things flying around in the air dropping missiles on people. That's not law and order and peace. That's military conflict. So, you know, can the Iraqi security forces and the Ministry of the Interior, can they develop a constabulary that enforces law and order, that has a system of courts and judges, and have an internal investigative body, you know, like the FBI, but is not viewed as a secret police? I don't know if they can do those things or not, but, you know, I think they can if they're willing to listen to us and to our partners who also want them to progress and to advance and to get better. They've got to be willing to listen and maybe not continue to hold on to some of the old ways. And again, you know, that is like asking a leopard to change its spots. It's asking them to change their culture. But I don't know beyond that what else we can do. But I do think that we have an obligation. We just can't allow ourselves to be taken advantage of at this point.
Yeah, as you were talking, I keep thinking, I think I read about this in the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. You know, Lawrence of Arabia dealt with a lot of the same issues. Talk about the influence of Iran. Did you see influence? And if so, what was it?
Yeah, a challenge for sure. I'll tell you that we did not see any direct influence by Iran. You know, anything that we could tie directly back and say, yep, Iran directed that, or Iran told these guys to do this. What we did see a lot of were the Shia militia groups that were part of the Iraqi PMF, who, quite frankly, they hated us. You know, they didn't want to have anything to do with the Americans, and there was a lot of conflict between interpersonal conflict between the Iraqi army and the PMF. And it was compounded in the area that I was working in because the 7th Iraqi Army Division is a predominantly Sunni organization. And the Iraqi general who I advised was, you know, he was a classic Sunni Iraqi military officer. And he and the PMF leaders were like oil and water. Man, they did not mix at all. And so there were times, and there was a period of weeks, actually, earlier in the spring, late winter, early spring, when the Americans, we could not go outside the wire of either al-Assad or our assembly area and operating base out in Al-Qaim because the Iraqi army did not want us to leave the wire, because from their perspective, they said they could not they could not protect us, which meant a lot, this was extremely significant because in that culture, if you are invited into someone's home as a guest, it's their obligation to protect you. It's in the Bedouin culture. It's also in the Iraqi Arab culture of, I have invited you in, so it's my obligation to protect you. So that was expanded to the invitation to the United States and the coalition to come into Iraq to help support the fight against ISIS. So that was how we had this mutually beneficial relationship with the ISF, where we would go out on operations with them, we would move forward into the battle space with them, understanding that it was their obligation to protect us. You know, we were going to conduct our own force protection, but they would never put us in a place where they thought that we were going to get attacked either by ISIS or somebody else. So, you know, back in the February time frame, when all of a sudden our ISF partners were saying, we don't want you to leave the wire because we can no longer protect you, that was significant. And what that meant to me was, okay, we maybe now have a bigger problem to deal with and think about than ISIS. ISIS, by that point, by December of 2017, ISIS in Anbar was gone. It was smashed. Was it becoming an underground movement or an insurgency? Perhaps. But as a military organization and an organization that was holding ground, as we talked about earlier, ISIS was destroyed at that point. But now we had this, you know, what this kind of developing internecine conflict between the ISF, the Iraqi Army, and the PMF, that was in the same occupying the same battle space as the ISF, and there was a lot of harsh talk, there was a lot of hand gestures, and there was also a lot of discussion between the two of them about, hey, let me tell you what's going to happen when the Americans leave. And that's what we figured out as my team was leaving and the next team was coming in, was, you know, quite frankly, the Iraqi army and the tribal sheikhs in Anbar and the tribal militia forces, all of the Sunnis in Al-Anbar, they wanted and still want the Americans to stay. And the primary reason that they want us to stay is to protect them against what's going to happen when we leave. And that is, you know, some kind of conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis. So that's one of those things that, if anything, keeps me up at night about that deployment that I did with the task force and with the Iraqis was, okay, when the U.S. leaves and the coalition leaves, what's going to happen to all those guys that I was out there supporting?
Yeah, that's a shadow. At one moment encouraging that you're looked at as an invited guest and then the vision of what might come. Hey, as we come near the end of the show, man, it's been a fast hour, Seth. I wanted to shift gears for you here. I want to make a program manager out of you. You've been at this for a while, three times in Iraq. You've been in Afghanistan. You've led Marines in some of the most challenging and enduring series of operations we've had without a break for years. And what if Colonel Seth Folsom, United States Marine Corps, was given a few $1 billion of a funding line and informed what it's been with your Marines on the ground? What bit of kit would Colonel Folsom want to invest those billions of dollars to give to his Marines?
I'll tell you first and foremost, this is completely non sequitur. It probably has nothing to do with what we're talking about. But if I controlled funding lines and equipment and fielding, I would invest in some sort of Tony Stark unobtainium that would lighten the equipment that we use, because I'll tell you that it boggles my mind that 15 plus years since I was in Iraq as a company commander during the invasion, the equipment that we have, there is more of it, and it's heavier, and it's a physically tough life. And so if there was some one thing that I could figure out to do, it would be how to lighten the load of not just infantrymen, but of all service members. When I look around, I used to have these, again, I had these conversations a lot when I was with my team. I would look around at some of the special ops people that were floating around the battle space, and I would look at the stuff that they had, and I would turn back to my team and say, it'd be nice to have that, but we're only general purpose forces and we don't get that. So, you know, but maybe to be something a little more relevant to the conversation, I would say that, you know, I'll tell you what made the difference with us was communications, the communications suite that we had. If there were certain systems that we had that if they had not been operational or we had not been able to get a hold of them, you know, our support to the Iraqis wouldn't have happened. So, you know, light, mobile, effective, encrypted communications, it's one of those things that it's the way of the future. And I know there are systems out there in the civilian world, but they're not necessarily marine-proof, and that's why they have to go through all of the testing and the acquisition process that the military has, that people throw darts at all the time. But, you know, the bottom line when it comes to money is like time and it's like people. You never have enough, and it's all about prioritization. So, I don't know. I guess maybe I'd have to think a little more about that and then shoot you a note on Twitter.
Well, thank you, Seth, for coming on with us today. It's been, as Sal said, a very fast and fascinating hour. Can we look forward to something from you? You've got a fourth book in you, or what are you going to be doing next other than working your rear end off as a staff guy?
Well, you know, I'll never say never, and I told the men and women on my team when they asked me, you know, hey, is there going to be another book out of this? I told them the same thing that I've told the other Marines that I've served with in operational units. I never set out to write a book when I'm going into a command, because that would you know, that would poison the well. But what I'll tell you is, I took a lot of notes when I was in country. I kept a journal as I always do, and there's a lot of material. To tell the story of Task Force Line. And that's the thing that I've been most concerned with throughout my time with the team and afterward, after we all broke apart when we came back. And that was telling the story of these young men and women who were in the shadows the entire time, but played played the critical role in supporting the Iraqis to destroy ISIS and Anbar. So if there's a story that comes out of it, that's what it's going to be. And it's going to be about, you know, this unknown team that if you ask the average Marine or sailor or soldier, you know, who Task Force Lion is, you know, they'll know after that.
Well, Seth, whatever comes out the other end, I really look forward to seeing it. You're a talented writer, and you're a good advocate for your Marines and what they do. And, hey, I hope you and your family enjoy having you back and have a good summer in California.
Well, I certainly appreciate it, and I thank you both again for the invite here. It was great catching up with you, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Yes, sir.
And it's been a pleasure.
I'd like to thank everybody for joining us for another edition of MidRats, and make sure and come join us again next week when our guest will be retired Admiral John Harvey. He's going to come on and discuss with us his view on the conditions that led up to the collisions of 2017 in Westpac with the Fitzgerald, McCain, and related topics. Until then, I hope you have a great Navy and Marine Corps day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. The sweetest girl I know. Goodbye. the difference.